From the Public Health Reporting Collaborative Side Effects Public Media, this is The Workaround.
Stories of the creative and sometimes shocking things people do to get around America's healthcare system and get the help they need.
I'm Bram Sable-Smith.
And I'm Emily Foreman.
So tell me, what's this workaround we're talking about today?
So I found that there are these transplant doctors in Philadelphia who are infecting their patients with hepatitis C on purpose in order to save their lives.
What?
So here's what's happening. A team of transplant surgeons at the University of Pennsylvania have set up a clinical trial. They are offering hepatitis C infected organs to patients who are stuck waiting on the organ donor list. And they started with kidneys.
That sounds risky.
Yeah, that's what I thought when I first read about the trial. Hepatitis C is not something you want to put in your body. For starters, left untreated, it gradually destroys your liver. It can kill you. And even though there's a cure, it's very hard to access that cure.
Okay, hard to access how?
Because it's expensive. A course of treatment can cost as much as $90,000, and some insurance providers try to avoid covering it. In some cases, they may wait until a person needs a new liver.
So you have people waiting on the organ donor list, and these doctors are offering them organs with a catch. The organs have hepatitis C, but then they're going to try to cure it, I guess.
Yep.
So who's going to say yes to an organ with hepatitis C in it?
Kieran Chalot of Yardley, Pennsylvania. That's who.
First time I saw my swollen legs, I was terrified. And that is like a real indication of kidney failures.
So I met Kieran and his wife, Chetna, at their home in Yardley, Pennsylvania. They were dressed the same.
I like how you and your wife are matching.
Yeah.
They're both wearing lavender shirts and black slacks.
Does that happen when you've been together for a long time?
Yeah, I think so.
You start dressing the same?
Yeah, that's exactly what she's saying.
Kieran is 65 years old and one of the first people to participate in the kidney transplant trial. The doctors at UPenn helped put me in touch.
Okay, so that's how you found him, but how did doctors find Kieran?
So the doctors took a look at the people on the wait list to receive kidneys, and they looked at anyone who was facing a really long wait time, maybe 5 years, until they'd get an organ. And then they just cold called everyone that fit the criteria.
What? So they just went down a list and cold called every person they could find and say, hey, can we infect you with hepatitis C?
Basically, the doctors compared it to calling to set up a blind date. It was kind of awkward.
So I know why someone would say yes to a blind date. Why would Kieran say yes to this?
So the story starts several years ago. Kieran had this autoimmune disease called IgA nephropathy. It's also known as Berger's disease. Basically, Kieran's filtration system that keeps his kidneys running started attacking itself. And to delay the damage, he had to take a high dose of prednisone, which has severe side effects. Bloating.
I mean, I could not put my shoes on, regular shoes on.
Hair loss.
You know, I don't have much hair to begin with, but it started whatever was there, you know, from hair, from everybody else, you just lose. And your face gets swollen, falling off hair. It's almost like a oral chemo.
At one point, Kieran even lost vision in his right eye because there was so much fluid buildup in his system that his retina detached. At the time, he was partially blind. And through all of this, he keeps working his job as a civil engineer at the New Jersey Department of Transportation.
You know, I was just always an optimistic person that, you know, things are going to work out. So I did not slow down, for example, going to work or going to gym or participating in the other thing. Well, I kind of looked different and felt different, but I still wanted to be, you know, going along.
But all of these symptoms ultimately mean kidney failure. His doctor tells him it's time to consider transplantation.
It was shocking. You know, it's like, you know, you're on timer now. If you don't do this and if you don't go for transplantation, this is going to end.
Around this time, his family went through a pretty extreme tragedy. His son died, and Kieran wanted to be there for his family. He wanted to live.
I was terrified. I was just wanted to survive it no matter what. It just, you know, I cannot put this family through this.
So Kieran signs up for a new kidney, and he waits. Meanwhile, to stay alive, he's on dialysis to do the job his kidney can't. Kieran opts for a self-administered dialysis machine. It runs all night while he sleeps. That way, he can keep his job.
So it's almost like having a tea bag. You know, in water, you're dipping a tea bag.
What he means by this is the dialysis machine pumps fluid into his abdomen, and the fluid is like a tea bag. It sops up the toxins that your kidneys don't have the strength to filter. The toxin-filled fluid is then pumped out of your body.
How easy was it to sleep at night?
It wasn't.
A year goes by, and still, no kidney. At this point, Kieran is so exhausted, he can barely walk the length of parking lot from his car to his office. So he calls to check how long he has left to wait.
So that was like, I kind of expected. She said, well, you know, there are thousands in front of you still. And, you know, the way that the rate it's going, it could be at least 5 years. To go through the similar thing for four more additional years was a pretty tall order.
So seeing 5 years to wait and feeling how he was feeling was just completely demoralizing. And Kieran is not alone. Right now, there aren't enough organs for people who need organ transplants. Roughly 100,000 people are waiting to receive kidneys. And something like 5% of that wait list dies every year waiting.
I have to just fight for a few lot more years ahead. You know, I just cannot give up.
But then he gets a call that same week from a Dr. Goldberg. And that call changes everything. So I want to leave Kieran for a second.
Okay.
And I want you to meet this person because in a way their story really ties to the opportunity that Kieran got. Her name is Robin Pearson.
Hi.
Hey, Robin. Robin lives in Brownsburg, Indiana. Her neighborhood is surrounded by highway ramps and cornfields. Her three-year-old granddaughter, Piper, takes a nap inside. We sit in her garage, which is really like a makeshift living room. It's carpeted, there's an adult-sized sofa, and there's a pink toddler-sized sofa decorated with Minnie Mouse and polka dots. I'm here to talk with Robin about her daughter, Ashley.
She was very bright. She was very beautiful. Probably, let's see, 6 years ago, she was 17 when she started using heroin. When she was 16, she took pills. And a good friend of hers at 17 said, you should try this. And she was dumb enough to do so. And that was the beginning of the end.
Ashley decided to quit when she was 19. She went to a detox center in Indianapolis. They gave her a 90-day supply of Suboxone to control her opioid cravings. There's a lot of restrictions placed on Suboxone, and it can be difficult to get insurance to cover it. After 90 days, she got cut off. And around that time, Ashley finds out that she's pregnant.
So I always felt that God let her have that baby to save her. You know, because she never did drugs again. You know what I mean? That was like when she became clean.
She also finds out she has hepatitis C, likely from her previous drug use. At this point, Ashley is off drugs. She's taking medication for the hepatitis C. She gives birth to her daughter, Piper. She's in a 12-step program and gets really into Bible study. She talks about enrolling in online courses to become a drug and alcohol counselor.
She was very spiritual. She got up every morning at 5 and read her Bible. It was annoying sometimes because she'd be all sprawled out through the kitchen.
Okay, so how does Ashley's story connect to this workaround?
Well, I mentioned Ashley contracted hepatitis C. And the trial in Pennsylvania are offering hepatitis C-infected kidneys to patients. And the first 10 patients that received these kidneys, 7 of those donors died of an opioid overdose.
Is that what happened to Ashley?
Well, Ashley had an Aunt Sarah. They were more like sisters or best friends than aunt and niece because they were so close in age. So one day, it's been about 3 years since Ashley last used drugs. Sarah dies unexpectedly. She chokes on something at a party. A month later, on Sarah's birthday, Ashley overdoses on heroin.
Sarah died February 8th. Her birthday was March 19th. And Ashley overdosed on March 19th, Sarah's birthday.
I think Robin really thought her daughter was going to make it. She was thinking about her future. And it had been 3 years since she used drugs.
I mean, I wasn't worried about her. That's why I was so sad, because I was over the worry. You know, she had been doing so well. They say with heroin, it's 5 years. If you made it 5 years, then you probably got it beat. Anything less? Maybe not.
You know, as health reporters, we've covered a lot of these stories. Young people are dying of drug overdoses at record-breaking rates. I mean, the New York Times estimated around 60,000 people died of an overdose in 2016.
Right. Yeah, we're in the middle of an opioid overdose crisis in the United States right now. More people are dying from opioid overdoses than they're dying in car crashes.
And it's young people who are dying. Meanwhile, many of them can't donate their organs, even if they're organ donors.
Why is that?
Because, like Ashley, they had hepatitis C. You see, up until the trial at UPenn, only people who already had hepatitis C could request hepatitis C positive organs. But that's only a small number of people. That leaves hundreds a year that don't find a match. The doctors at UPenn noticed this and calculated we throw away 800 hepatitis C positive organs a year, many of which are otherwise healthy organs. There's a bit of a backstory as to why we haven't been transplanting more hepatitis C infected organs. A lot of people in the medical community cringe when they hear hepatitis C. And there's a reason for that. It's because of old ways of treating the disease. It used to be treated with something called interferon therapy. You'd have to inject the medication, and the result was you felt these horrible flu-like symptoms, and it caused depression and anxiety. And the people that were on it, they just weren't themselves. It just sort of altered your personality.
Right, but was it effective?
No, it only worked half the time. But this medication posed a real problem for people who needed a transplant.
How so?
Say you need a kidney transplant. In order to keep the kidney and prevent your body from rejecting it, you need to take immunosuppressants. And the old hepatitis C medication did not mix well with the immunosuppressants. Fairly often, people took both and lost the organ after transplant. The other problem when you take immunosuppressants, the body's guard is down. So when you have a virus like hepatitis C, there's a chance the virus is going to reproduce much faster.
Right, because your body can't fight back.
Exactly. And hepatitis C destroys your liver. So if the virus runs rampant in your body, your liver is going to degrade at a rapid rate. And before you know it, you might need to show up for another transplant.
So you could get a kidney and lose a liver all in one process.
That was the fear with the trial. But there's a bit of a blind spot there, because there's a new hepatitis C treatment, and it's a lot better. It's been on the market for several years. Instead of a shot, it's a pill that you take once a day for a few months. You know, people taking the medication say they don't feel any side effects. And it has a really high cure rate. Almost everyone who takes it gets rid of the virus for good. But still, those old memories of hepatitis C treatment left an impression on some of the surgeons at UPenn.
So here we are at the convergence of some pretty incredible moments right now. We have an opioid epidemic where deaths are skyrocketing. And we also have all these organs, but many of them are potentially unusable because they're infected with hepatitis C. But at the same time, we have this huge list of people waiting 5 years, sometimes even dying in the waiting process. And then these doctors at University of Pennsylvania have this crazy idea. Let's use those organs anyway and then try to cure hepatitis C?
Yeah.
Okay, so everything seems like it's converging into this one study. Who are these doctors?
I've done some trials before. Never where I was the one who designed the whole trial from start to finish, but also never one that I was so invested.
This is Dr. David Goldberg. He's a liver doctor on the transplant team at UPenn, the same Goldberg that called Kieran with an offer he could not refuse.
You get emotionally invested in these people, you know, like many of them I know their families. I met them on several occasions and you sort of root for them.
Dr. Goldberg is 38 years old, which he likes to mention is still within the ideal donor age bracket. And when he started to look into how donors his age were dying, he said he found it pretty sobering.
There were almost as many donors who died from traditional causes, trauma, gunshot wounds, things like that, of young donors, as there were donors who died of a drug overdose as the mechanism of death.
Dr. Goldberg partnered with Dr. Peter Rees to design the trial. Dr. Rees is a kidney doctor on the transplant team.
Getting on the waiting list is, you know, it takes a lot of work, and it's an act of hope that one day, you know, you'll make it to the operating room and someone will offer you a good organ. But for many people, they never make it that far.
Together, they pitched the idea to their colleagues.
There was still a visceral response, understandably, to infecting someone with what you had learned in medical school as a life-threatening infection.
This idea wasn't scary for Dr. Goldberg, who is a liver doctor and had a lot of experience treating hepatitis C. And Dr. Rees, he'd had a close family member suffer through the old hepatitis treatment, and he knows how far the new medication has come.
Many of our physician colleagues were very worried about it. They were worried that patients could be harmed. They were worried that if patients came to harm, that it might reflect badly on the institution.
Some of the surgeons took convincing because it was easy for me as a liver doctor and Peter Rees as a kidney doctor to say, this is great, you should do it. But we were the ones physically giving someone hepatitis C.
The guy who is physically infecting people with hepatitis C is the kidney transplant surgeon, Dr. Peter Apt. So I really wanted to talk to him about the kind of pressure he must have felt. I mean, he places the diseased organ into someone's body.
My role, I'm a liver, kidney, and pancreas transplant surgeon.
I've never seen a picture of him. We only talked over the phone. But doesn't he sound like Toby from The Office?
I can hear it.
So I'm picturing Toby from The Office, and I'm listening to him talk about this trial. It's probably one of the most innovative things he's done in his entire career. Did you transplant the first kidney with the Thinker trial?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I can't remember.
You don't remember if you were the first to do it, but do you remember the first time that you transplanted a hepatitis C-infected kidney into an uninfected patient?
No, I don't remember the first time, to tell you the truth.
Okay, so the doctors feel pretty confident. How did Kieran feel?
Remember, Kieran was very depressed about the wait time. He was working all day as an engineer, doing dialysis at night, and facing a long wait on the organ transplant list. Then he gets a call, and it's Dr. Goldberg on the other line. At first, he was a little confused as to why a liver doctor he'd never met called him about a kidney. But then he listened.
He said, you know, this will make your wait time go down to maybe months. And that's when my ears were perked up. I said, yes, I'm interested.
So did Kieran decide to do it?
Well, during his in-person consultation, he had one big question. Dr. Goldberg remembers it well.
If you had a loved one, would you let them be in the study? And, you know, my grandfather, who wouldn't have been eligible, he'd been on dialysis, and I saw what his life was like. And I believe a relative of Peter, I don't know who was on it, so we were both unequivocally like, yes. I think that gave him peace, but it also, you know, neither of us hesitated. It sort of gave me a sense of peace, like, you know, I'm not just saying this for the purposes of research. You know, it truly is what I believe.
And that meant a lot to Kieran.
Without any hesitation, the Dr. Goldberg said, yes, I would. Definitely I would. So he sounded so confident and so positive thinking. I said, well, that's my answer. That kind of nailed it.
And this conversation with Kieran would provide Dr. Goldberg with the language to pitch other patients.
So how long did it take between the first consultation and getting Kieran into surgery?
So I think about a month later. So I was, this was May, okay? And so June, a few weeks after we signed the consent, and I was sitting by the phone. Nothing was ringing at that time. So, but they told me to leave the phone on and, you know, be sure that you're close to it because this is very important. I mean, if I'm not available, it goes to somebody else.
As you can hear, he always leaves his phone on. Kieran had two false alarms. Doctors test the blood first to make sure it's the right type of hepatitis C, so that way they know whether the medication will work.
So there were some nights that we were called and we had to get only used donors who had specific types of hepatitis C. So I would be on edge knowing, is it the right type? And I think my wife got to be on edge as well once in a while.
He signed up in June and he gets a call in August. It's Dr. Goldberg and he says it's time to come and get your kidney.
So that was like, oh my God, this is really happening. This is like not even a possibility someday. This is it right now. We had been to the hospital several times in the past. On our way, we lost three times.
Oh, you get lost.
We were like so excited and, you know, just...
He's so now excited. He's calling his brother, his uncle. Oh, I'm getting kidney excited. Talking to everybody and I'm driving. I'm like, okay, which exit? Make sure I'm doing it right.
Right before he rolls into surgery, Dr. Goldberg drops in and says, now this kidney, I would definitely give this to a family member.
But... did he develop hepatitis C?
Yes, he gets hepatitis C.
Okay, and did they cure him? Like, did it work?
Well, let me just play you this bit of tape. Can you hear that?
Yeah. What is it?
So that's the sound of Kieran breathing in a headstand in the middle of his living room.
So Kieran's feeling good.
Yeah. He's like, he's feeling really good.
Like I've been saying all along, like I'm feeling as if I felt maybe 10, 12 years ago. So it really, the energy level is phenomenal.
Okay, so this worked.
And not just for Kieran. Every person that participated in the trial, they all got hepatitis C. And they're all cured of it. And they all kept their organs.
Wow, how many people?
20 patients total. I mean, there's an ongoing trial that they haven't published yet, but I think it's now closer to 40 people.
Okay. Wow. Okay, so it seems like we're seeing a watershed moment with transplants then.
There's a catch, though. Hepatitis C medication is expensive, and one of the main reasons this trial was possible is because the doctors at University of Pennsylvania were able to persuade Merck, which is a pharmaceutical company, to donate hepatitis C medication, but not forever. So in the meanwhile, they're trying to do this procedure for as many people as possible and show its success.
Yeah, make a long-term case for insurers to invest in coverage of this medication for this specific purpose, right? Like they're trying to build the case to the insurance companies that they could save money by just covering this.
Right, and they already have a good case. Dialysis is expensive. It's cheaper to get a new kidney, the drugs you need to keep it, and the hepatitis C treatment, compared to living out the rest of your life on dialysis.
And it's not clear yet that they're buying our pitch, so to speak. What sort of paralyzes us is the idea that the insurance company will only say something like, we'll probably support it, or they won't say at all. Because the nightmare would be that you take a patient through the surgery, and then afterwards you have to tell them, wow, I can't get you the medicine, or I can't get it to you right away.
So here we are at this incredible convergence of events, and then there's even this nonchalance about it that it just seems like a very reasonable, practical thing to do, kind of like a no-brainer. And what strikes me as distinctly American about this whole thing is that the one hiccup in all of this is that we can't figure out how to pay for the enormous price of hepatitis C treatment.
Yeah, the medical workaround works. All that's left is the financial work.
Okay, but wait, there's still one more loose end, though. Ashley, how does she connect to this? Was hers the kidney that Kieran received?
That would be a twist, but no. Kieran didn't get Ashley's kidney. His donor was a man in his 40s from Michigan. Remember, Kieran's donor didn't get a hold of hepatitis C medication. Without the trial at UPenn, his kidney would have been thrown out. But Robin's daughter, Ashley, she had access to hepatitis C medication, and it cured her. When Ashley died, Robin says she could donate her organs.
So then she had a liver and kidney that were able to be used, one in Pennsylvania, and one, I'm not sure, I want to say Michigan.
Do you imagine who they are, even though you don't know? Do you still, do you
imagine? Yeah, I used to kind of think, you know, the first few months, it was the Pennsylvania guy who got the liver. There was a guy and a girl, and I pictured a young girl, young, beautiful girl who got to live on, and an old grumpy man who got more life and became happy.
I mean, anything else about what it feels like to lose your daughter and at the same time save two lives?
It made it not seem like as big a waste. It, no matter how you look at it, to lose a child is probably the worst thing you could ever go through. But at least someone was helped. They were saved due to her donations. And, you know, so on the worst day ever, at least there was something good.
You know, Robin has this photo in her living room that I keep thinking about. It's a close-up of four pairs of hands clasping each other in sort of a crisscross pattern. They belong to Robin, her oldest daughter, and Ashley. Ashley stands out because she has on this blue nail polish. And the photo was taken in the hospital after Ashley died, before the organ team took over. The fact that Robin framed this photo says a lot. That on the worst day of her life, there was still this incredible moment worth preserving.
So these organ donations are sort of, they're kind of the silver lining on the crisis our country's going through.
And I think what the story says, this trial at University of Pennsylvania, it gives us just a little bit of hope that people in our medical system can find workarounds to old ideas that make sure human life isn't wasted and is treated with dignity. And we use our innovation and care to find workarounds that save lives rather than destroy them. The Workaround is brought to you by Side Effects Public Media.
We're a regional health reporting group based at NPR member station WFYI in Indianapolis.
KBIA in Columbia, Missouri. St. Louis Public Radio. WILL in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. WNIN in Evansville, Indiana. And WOSU in Columbus, Ohio all contribute to Side Effects.
The Workaround is produced by Matt Hodapp and edited by Sadie Babbitts. Thanks to consultant Starley Kine for her early thinking on this project.
And finally, a special thanks to Carmel Roth. She's the former editor and founder of Side Effects Public Media, who created the idea of the Workaround.
I'm Bram Sable-Smith.
And I'm Emily Foreman. Thanks for listening.